Today's Teisho will be on case 35 in the Book of Serenity. Case 35 is entitled Luo Pu's Acquiescence. Introduction: quick action and swift intellect breaks the onslaught of outsiders and heavenly devils. Leaving convention and transcending sect indirectly help those of superior faculties with sharp wisdom. If you suddenly meet someone who doesn't turn his head when struck, what then? Case: when Luo Pu called on Jia Shan, without bowing, he stood right in front of him. Jia Shan said, "A chicken roosting in the phoenix nest. It's not the same species. Go away." Luo Pu said, "I've come from afar to find your way, teacher. I beg you for a reception." Jia Shan said, "Before my eyes, there is no you. Here, there is no me." Luo Pu then shouted. Jia Shan said, "Stop, stop. Don't be crude and careless. The moon in the clouds is the same. Valleys and mountains are different. It's not that you don't cut off the tongues of everyone on earth, but how can you make a tongueless person speak?" Luo Pu had nothing to say. Jia Shan hit him. To this, Luo Pu acquiesced. Verse: wagging his head, shaking his tail, the red-tailed fish. Independent through and through, he knows how to turn around. Even if he has the art to cut off tongues, pulling his nose around subtly conveyed the spirit. Outside the screen of luminous jewels, wind and moon are like day. In front of the cliff of dead trees, flowers and plants are always in spring. Tongueless man, tongueless man. When the true order's completely in hell, upheld in one knowing phrase, walking along in the kingdom clear and comprehending, let everyone in the land be happy and joyful. Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen today and for sitting. Many of you have been sitting for hours and so well. Good work. That's how it's done. You know, these koans are sometimes hard to understand when I read them aloud, assuming I read them correctly, for many reasons. They're challenging because they present a kind of contradiction. And they're also challenging because they're loaded with cultural references that most people in the West don't get. You know, Buddhism has a long history, 2,500-year history. There's an enormous body of sutras and commentaries on the sutras. Enormous. You know, in the Jewish world, there's one Bible. In the Christian world, there's one Bible. I mean, the Jewish people have Talmudic philosophy, so it's a little bit more complicated. But there's, you know, a small number of books. In Buddhism, there's a huge number of books, right? That's like 108 volumes in the Tibetan canon, Buddhist canon, and Chinese canon is also huge and sprawling. So, so many sutras, you know, you couldn't read them all, or you could, but you'd have nothing, you'd have no time for anything else. And Buddhist philosophy is very, very demanding. And in our sutra study group, we're going to read the Lankavatara Sutra, which is just very difficult. So, you know, Zen masters all read and studied the sutras, but they felt that the most important thing was practice. So you can study the sutras from now until the end of time, but unless you're actually doing what we're doing here this morning, sitting on the cushion and working through our obstacles, you're not going to wake up. It's as though you spent your life reading travel books without ever going to the country. So, you know, congratulations to everybody here. You know, the libraries are full of Buddhist books. There are religion studies programs and departments of religious studies. There in East Asia, there are institutes and so on and so on. But this is where it all happens. This is the real action. So, you know, you are the Dharma today. You are practicing the way. This is how people wake up. And the rest is commentary, right? The rest is just commentary. So Zen wanted people to appreciate that fact. So, you know, it does make references to all kinds of ideas from different schools of Buddhism and so on, but it's all written in a way that in the 13th century would have been very informal. So, you know, the references are to like pop culture of the time. So, you know, in the poem, the author of the poem in this collection, it would be the equivalent of our saying, you know, like Beyonce, you'll be such and such, you know, and don't, you know, or making reference to television shows, you know, or Veep. Don't be like Veep, you know. It's like so-and-so in Modern Family, right? You know, all these cultural references that people would have gotten at the time, right? But of course, 1,000 years from now, people won't remember the television show Veep, and they won't remember the Modern Family show, you know. They won't remember hit records, you know, and they won't remember who Beyonce was, you know. So all of this is sort of thrown in to be accessible to speak to people in about the world they knew, right? And it's full of references, so that makes it a little inaccessible too. But the strangeness is really an asset. Actually, I think the strangeness of it all is really an asset because it speaks to a deeper part of ourselves, right? I wasn't raised in the Catholic Church. I'm not Catholic, but I have always been fascinated by the fact that the Mass in the central public religious activity in Catholic Church is the saying of the Mass used to be in Latin, a language most people don't speak. And you know, there was a reform movement many years ago to institute living languages in the Mass. So the Mass isn't said in Latin anymore. And some people complained that, you know, actually some of the mystery went out of the Mass because they understood the meaning of the words. You know, and I actually think that's very deep. You know, sometimes the words we don't understand can speak to us more powerfully than the words we understand. You know, we recite sutras every morning during Sesshin and here on Saturday mornings. And the sutras are they're Japanese phonetic renderings of Chinese phonetic renderings of Sanskrit text. So the Chinese decided not to translate, but to simply try to imitate using Chinese sounds the Sanskrit words, and then the Japanese picked that up and tried to make it do the same thing with Japanese sounds. So it's doubly incomprehensible. But actually that's very profound, right? When you recite the sutras, it quickly takes you to a place beyond discriminating thought, and that's really liberating, really wonderful. So sometimes I think that the incomprehensibility of the sutras, of the koans, is a great asset, right? Anyway, you still need a little bit of background. So Here's basically the background of this story. Luopu was a monk who called on Master Jashan. And he comes into the Dharma hall to meet the master. And instead of bowing, right, instead of bowing as he should, he stands right in front of him. So he walks into the Dharma hall, and Jashan is there, and he sees this monk, and the monk doesn't bow as he should. He just stands there. Jashan says, what I see before me is a chicken roosting in a phoenix nest, right? In other words, a phoenix is this amazing, mysterious bird, right? This very beautiful, exotic bird that actually, catches on fire and burns up and then is reborn, right, out of the flames. It's like Dumbledore in Harry Potter had a phoenix, right? So this monk comes in and he's standing there in front of Jashan. He doesn't bow, and Jashan says, you might think you're the phoenix standing in front of me, but all I see is a chicken, right, sitting in a phoenix's nest. It's not the same species. Go away. Right? And then Luopu says, look, I've come a long way to see you. I beg you for a reception. Please, receive me formally. And Jashan says, look, as far as I'm concerned, there's no you here and there's no me. There's no one to receive and no one to be received. Luopu then shouted. This is shouted is a standard form of behavior in Zen. People, kots, they give this big shout. And that's another way of demonstrating your Zen virtuosity. It's a way of like demonstrating your Zen virtuosity. Ha! But Jashan says, stop, don't go for the Zen screams, please, the Zen shouts, don't do it. He says, don't be so crude and careless. The moon in the clouds is the same. The valleys and the mountains are different. And then some of this is rather hard to understand. It's not that you don't cut off the tongues of everyone on earth, but how can you make a tongueless person speak? Luopu had nothing to say. Jashan hit him. For to this, Luopu acquiesced. So that's basically the dynamic here. Is this young hotshot shows up, and the teacher says, "I don't think you really get it. I don't think you really get it. You know how to get beyond obedience to rules and regulations, but you don't have the essence of Zen. Right? You're not trapped by rules and regulations, but you don't have the essence of Zen. That's sort of the idea." So the key term here, if we do this koan together, the key word is acquiesce, or submit. Submit. Acquiesce. Submit. Now look, submit is not really submission, right? In English, the word submission is a really negative word, right? Submission, right? We even say, there's a phrase, abject submission. Like, you bow and scrape, you completely surrender your autonomy, and so on. Luopu is a monk who refuses to follow convention, right? And at the end of this story, it says he acquiesced, he surrendered, or he became subordinate, right? So he acquiesced, it meant he submitted. You might think, did he submit to Jashan's authority? Is that what this is all about? You know, he's a young monk, he comes to meet the master. The master puts him down, and finally he says, okay, I will be your servant, I will be your Dharma slave, and or whatever, you know. And, but that would be a misunderstanding of the koan, but it kind of raises all these questions, right? So I wonder if you've ever thought about what it is to be a monk, what it is to be a monk. You know, in classical Indian tradition, or in classical like Chinese tradition, Buddhist tradition, you know, to be a monk is to give up everything. It's like absolutely everything. So you know, when you are a monk or a nun and you're ordained, you give up your family name and your personal name. And you take another name. And in the course of your life, you may have a series of names. You know, usually you apply for admission to a temple, and you have a period where you are sort of on probation, you're a trainee. In Japanese, these are called cloud and water people, cloud and water people. And you're a trainee for maybe a year, and you have to go through all the temple life. And if you still want to be ordained, you can be ordained. Still answer to Kurt. The name on the mailbox says Spellmeyer. You know, if you're as in classical Zen training or classical Buddhist life, that would not be the case. So for example, Linji was not Linji's real name. We do know his name. We actually do know his family, the given name. But with many Zen masters, we don't even know their names. We don't know their names. Luo Pu, that's not his real name. That's not his family name. That's not his personal name. Jashan, not his name. So, it's easy to think, oh, how cool to be a monk, right? But, or how cool to be a nun, maybe you think. But when you think about it, the first thing you do is give up your identity. I mean, completely, you give up your identity. And you shave your head. And then basically what you're saying is, from now on, I will not aspire to be a person. Yeah, that's what you're actually saying. I will not aspire to be an individual person with characteristics that distinguish him or her from other people. You know, so if you see a group of monks, they all look pretty much the same. There might be tall ones and shorter ones, heavier ones and thinner ones, but they all, it's just like a row of bald heads, or same thing with nuns, it's like a row of bald heads. And, you know, there might be something actually rather like horrifying about this, right? So you know, most of us, a lot of us anyway, think, I am going to maybe, when I was young, I wanted to be a writer. And I loved fiction, I loved reading novels, and I wanted to be a novelist. And I have to confess that, you know, I wrote several novels that were like really terrible novels, you know, and I gave them to friends, and they were so tactful and diplomatic about it. You know, well, you know, you have so you keep going. You know, I had novelists I just loved. You know, among contemporary novelists, I loved Don DeLillo. I liked this guy named Thomas Pynchon. People don't necessarily read that fiction anymore, but at the time they were everywhere, you know. So in my American literature classes, we would read this James Joyce novel, or this Scott Fitzgerald novel, or Hemingway. And you know, at some part of my mind I said to myself, you know, I want to be like that. I want to be I love literature, but I want to write literature, and I want to be a novelist like Hemingway. I want people to say, and then there were the great novelists of the 20th century, you know, there was Ernest Hemingway, there was F. Scott Fitzgerald, there was Iris Murdoch, and there was that great Kurt Spelman. Now look, I don't think that's such a terrible thing, right? I mean, I dreamed of being a great novelist, right? And it turns out I didn't become a great novelist, you know. If you go into the sciences, you know, there's these heroes of science, right? I mean, somebody like Einstein, right, was just like, you know, in a couple of years, he completely revolutionized his field, like completely, you know. It's like there was Newton, then there was Einstein, right? And it's like, there's just like three or four figures. You think, you know, maybe if you get interested in physics, you know, you think, you know, I'd like to be another Einstein. You know, so there'd be, if I'd gone into physics, there'd be Newton, there'd be Einstein, and there'd be Spellmeyer. Right? So Spellmeyer, my parents would be so proud that I was a great physicist, you know. And if you go to, I'm a big art fan, right? So, you know, if you read the biographies of artists, you know, so many of them had such a powerful drive to create. But a lot of them also had like a powerful drive to be appreciated and to be, you know, to be famous, to be a famous artist, right? So, you know, Picasso was a shameless, Picasso's a great artist. Whatever people say, I think he's a truly great artist. But he was also like a shameless self-promoter, right? So, you know, he would do photo shoots and he'd come in with his red striped shirt and he'd polish up his bald head and he would perform these performances and he'd get written up in the magazines as a great genius and he very self-consciously, you know, it was like he was in the Picasso, he was a great artist, but he was also in the Picasso business, right? It was like promoting Picasso, making the word Picasso a household word. So, you know, many young artists, you know, dream of being a Picasso or being a Richard Diebenkorn or being another Jackson Pollock. You know, Jackson Pollock was a great artist, but he was so tormented by this desire to be somebody, right? To be somebody. And his part of his art was just driven by this compulsion to be loved and appreciated and so on, and it really destroyed him, right? Because when he couldn't paint paintings that everybody said were great paintings, he felt terrible about himself. And then when he could paint paintings that everybody said were great paintings, then he kept repeating himself, and they kept saying, "What's wrong with you? Can't you do anything new?" And then when he tried new things, it wasn't as good as the old things, and then he would drink, and he would drink and drink, right? So Hemingway was the same story, right? You know, Hemingway started out wanting to write, loving to write. He didn't know he was going to become a famous writer. He just wanted to write. And in the process, he became Ernest Hemingway. Right? He became a name, and he had to live up to his name. So everything he did had to be as brilliant as the thing he did before. And this drove him, again, you know, into alcoholism, right? Because he couldn't quite top his earliest novels. And everything was a competition with himself. So look, you know, it seems terrible in a certain way that I could say, I give up my name. I give up any hope that someday people will remember my name. You know, if you go to Buddhist countries in anywhere in the Asian world, you see all these monks and nuns. You see them everywhere. Like in Thailand, they're everywhere, right? In Taiwan, lots of nuns. More nuns in Taiwan than monks, as a matter of fact. You should see there are so many. None of those people are going to be remembered. They don't use their real name, their given names. They all have names, monastic names. None of them are going to be remembered, even for a moment, by anyone. And you could think, oh my God, what a horrible fate. You know, in the world of English professors, when we think of immortality, we think of William Shakespeare, right? We think of William and in fact, Shakespeare has a poem that says, Shakespeare has this one, it's a sonnet. Shakespeare has a sonnet that says, I am such a great poet, that he's writing it to this woman he loves. He says, I am such a great poet that, you know, you wouldn't normally be remembered, but now that I've put you in my poem, everybody's going to remember you forever. You know, that's what he actually says in so many words, more elegantly said, right? But, you know, in English we think the immortal Shakespeare. Like Shakespeare, humans come and go, but Shakespeare is for eternity. In France, you know, they actually have a French Academy, and they call the recipients, these philosophers and artists, they call them the immortals, right? They're actually immortal. Their names will be remembered forever. You know, that's true in many fields, like there are certain medical innovators whose names will be, but you know, actually, these monks and nuns give this up. They're never going to be Shakespeare. You know, Lin Ji, we don't know who he was. We don't know anything about Lin Ji. We talk about Lin Ji, we say, well, this is Lin Ji's end. We don't know anything about Lin Ji. You know, Luo Pu, that's not his real name. We don't know anything about him. And you could say to yourself, what a terrible fate. You know, you're giving up your chance of being fully realized self, a fully realized person with a name, and the name becomes famous, and it outlives you, and people afterwards will remember you fondly forever, and they've given this up. And you can say, what a terrible fate. It's like being sealed in a tomb while you're still alive. It runs counter to everything we believe, I think, in the modern Western world. You know, when I was growing up, my father used to say, Kurt, you need to make your mark in this world. You need to leave some mark. You need to make your mark. Leave behind something so somebody will go, yeah, I remember him. You know, he did X. And monks and nuns give that up completely, and it could seem horrifying, right? It could seem horrifying. But then you think about the fact that, you know, if you told somebody you practice meditation and you sit down on a cushion for an hour a day and you stop being Kurt and you become no one at all, lots of people would be, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to do that? I actually gave a lecture once on Buddhism, and I was talking about the experience of having no self on the cushion, and somebody was so upset. He actually came up to me, and he was deeply disturbed by that. Why would you want to be no self, right? I mean, he had a theological argument. He said, God created you to be Kurt, you know. You're supposed to be a person. And, you know, but actually, and there are many people who would find the idea of sitting on the cushion and no longer being a person, no longer being Kurt, like a terrible thing, like the worst thing that could happen, to be being no one, going nowhere, you know. But actually, when you sit down on the cushion and you begin to watch your breath, you know, what happens is it feels so wonderful not to be Kurt. It feels so wonderful. It's like suddenly you're set free from all these expectations and all of these, the expectations and the failures to live up to expectations. And you can simply be present in the moment without judgment. And the terrible burden of being a person is temporarily taken off your shoulders. And you know, we spend so much time worrying about whether we're the person we should be or not, and we're discouraged that we're not, or we're hopeful that we will someday be the person, and so on and so on. When all of that goes away and you're just in the moment, it's just so wonderful. It's so wonderful. You know, people work so hard to be quote unquote individuals. They work so hard to be individuals, right? So, you know, when you were growing up, you know, if your brother liked football, you might have thought, well, I'm not going into football. I'm going to do something else. You might not have consciously decided, but lots of people make life decisions because they're trying to be a person. They're trying to make their mark. And yet, you know, that often becomes this terrible burden, right? Terrible burden. And, you know, when you become a monk or nun, you know, actually you just give that up. It's like, I am not going to be a person. I'm just going to be present moment by moment and not worry about who or what I am. And actually, you know, I'm going to be present for other people, you know, available to help them work through their issues and their problems, right? That's sort of the life of the Buddhist monk or the Buddhist nun. And, you know, actually, even though it might seem like a terrible fate not to have a name, no longer have a history, no longer have a future as a self, you know, I would say that monks and nuns are the freest people in the world. Absolutely, no question. You know, they live in this moment without, you know, ideally at least, they live in this moment without expectation, without aspiration. You know, the one goal is to cultivate awakened mind and manifest compassion. So this is a koan about somebody who maybe hasn't done that, you know, who's kind of gotten off on the wrong track, or has it, right? So monks and nuns are supposed to be selfless, and they're supposed to be people who no longer want to make a name for themselves or leave a mark. They don't want to do that because they understand how imprisoning that is. And also, they don't want to do it because it will lead others into samsara. Other people if they can't show how it's possible to be free from selfhood, from the aspiration to selfhood, from the fantasies of selfhood, then other people will be dragged into suffering, right? If they can live out the selfless life, right? And people say, oh my gosh, those monks and nuns are the freest people in the world, then other people will be inspired, right? Inspired to be less self-centered, to be less concerned about becoming a fully realized person and more aware of just being fully present in the moment. I hope that's making some sense. So when Luopu calls on Jiashan, you know, he presents himself without bowing. And you know, the question here in the koan is, you know, is Luopu a person who is truly free from striving to be a self, to be recognized and approved of? Or is he really somebody who, is desperate for the approval of his teacher, or desperate for the approval of his teacher? You know, Buddhist communities are constructed to give people a chance, or monastic communities are constructed to give people a chance to be free from the self. If you think about who, you know, basically, you don't pick your parents, you don't pick your race, you don't pick your gender, right? None of those are choices, you know. You know, and yet as you grow up and as you live your life, it's like you have all of these scripts you have to act out. You know, if you're a woman, you're expected to do this. If you're a man, you're expected to do this. If you're a person of a certain heritage, you're expected to do that. You know, so you're constantly trying to live out all these scripts, and you know the scripts are full of contradictions and mistranslations, and So we're never quite getting it right, and we're always feeling very, very guilty. I think most people, there is an Einstein, there is a Picasso, there is a Beyonce. I have to say, I enjoy her music very much, So all good, right? The desire to be a Beyonce is, or the desire to be a Picasso, or the desire to be a Shakespeare, these are profoundly crippling and disabling, and are the source of endless unhappiness, if I may say so. If you sit down to write a novel, as I did, to be a famous novelist, that's like a poisonous situation. Because every word you write has to be brilliant, right? And you can't really learn from the process, right? You can't really learn. Shakespeare didn't set out to be Shakespeare. If you know anything about Shakespeare, actually, he started out in the theater world, probably as an actor or working as a stagehand. He got into the theater. He got really interested in the theater. And he eventually went from, production assistant and so on to actually writing a script a try, So he actually, gave it a try. He started writing scripts, and it turns out the scripts were really good. They were really good. He didn't set out to be the greatest genius in the English language. He just liked the theater, and he gave writing these scripts a try. And they were performed, and they were very successful, and they made him a lot of money. Shakespeare actually was financially successful. It's like, as this went on, he thought, this is working out for me. I'll just keep writing these scripts. He didn't imagine that these plays, these scripts, would someday be collected and read like 600 years later and worshipped as like holy scripture. He just thought, here's an entertaining idea. I'll put this in the story, and the audience will love it, right? It's not at all clear that Shakespeare saw himself as an artist. He saw himself kind of as like a businessman, as a theater man, right? So the interesting thing about Shakespeare is that he didn't set out to be the greatest writer in the English language. He was just playing around with the possibilities offered to him by his life. He was following his curiosity, he was following his interests, he was open to possibilities, and some of those possibilities he realized, right? So often it's the case that things we really value are not things we control. There are things the things we do in life that we value the most sometimes happen to us by accident, and we respond to them in a very open way because we have no expectations. Right? So I just happened to go to the University of Washington one Wednesday night, and I met Genki Roshi, and I never wanted to be anything in the world of Buddhism. I certainly didn't want to be like the Dalai Lama or something. I was just in a lot of psychological pain, and when I started sitting, I felt better. And Genki Roshi was not a famous person in the world of Zen Buddhism. If you go to Japan, and my teacher Webb trained with a guy named Soko Morinaga, and if you go to Japan and you say, "Do you know Soko Morinaga?" they go, "Oh, the great Soko Morinaga." If you say, "What about the great Genki Roshi?" they say, "Who's that?" When Shakespeare was just interested in the theater, he was just being present, without aspiring to be somebody or have a name or anything like that. His relationship to the theater was really pure. It's really pure. It's just openness to what's happening. It's the openness to what's happening. Very pure. You know, when you begin to have aspirations to be a great writer, now the relationship is no longer pure, right? It's now blocked at every turn by your expectations and disappointments, right? So this is a monk, Luo Pu, who seems to be like, he's given up his name, he's given up his home, he's given up everything, but he hasn't given it up, right? He's trying to make a name for himself. He wants to be the great, everybody goes, oh, the great Luo Pu, he's a great master of Zen. He shows up at the temple and he doesn't even bow, see? So even if people give up everything, they still hold on to that mentality of, let me make my mark, let me be somebody. It's grasping, right? The word for this is grasping. There's such a thing as like spiritual ambition, which is just like financial ambition, right? So you can never have enough money, you can never be famous enough. Even Beyonce probably wishes she were somebody else, right? You know, and says, oh, I'm not as famous as so-and-so, right? You know, that's toxic. Trying to be a self from the Buddhist standpoint is actually toxic. That's what we think, right? Because, you know, we model ourselves on other people. We try to be like other people, and we can't be like other people. And we make ourselves unhappy, right? We can't even be like ourselves yesterday. So, like, poor Hemingway wrote a couple of really great books, and then he couldn't do it anymore, and it tormented him. And same with Jackson Pollock, right? It's like when Jackson Pollock was just stumbling along, he found this style that was blew people's minds. You know, about 15 years ago, they had a show at the Met of Jackson Pollock, and people were lined out the door. You know, and if he were alive, he would have said, oh, I made it, I really, but you know, that became his prison house, because now he had to repeat that style over and over again, could never do anything new, and became very unhappy, became a prisoner of his identity, right, actually. And it became a straitjacket for him. It's so wonderful not to be a self, actually. You know, in the West, everything is about being a self, right? It's like we say, don't imitate others, be yourself. But being yourself is imitating others. So to truly practice the great way is to be that awareness you become on the cushion. You know, when you're in deep samadhi, there's no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. There's no self. There's just this moment, just this beautiful moment. And you're not accepting or rejecting anything. You're just present with it. See? And the ideal life, according to Buddhism, is to go through life just like that. You know, you're not grasping at anything. You're not aspiring, you're not afraid, you're none of those things. You're just present with what's happening. And when you're truly present with what's happening, compassion is your natural emotional state, believe it or not. So somebody like Luo Pu has done something pretty, the world of Buddhism is filled with such people, right? You know, people take vows, they get rid of their names, they promise to be empty, they promise to be selfless. But, you know, they turn it into a way of being a self. They want to be a famous rock star Buddhist teacher, right? You know, and unfortunately, Luo Pu is that kind of person. He's taken renunciation and turned it into a way of having a self. Right, he's becoming a brand, the Luo Pu brand of Buddhism. You know, years ago, I had a friend of mine in Seattle when I was training at the Seattle Zen Center who was totally in love with the Dalai Lama. And he would actually go to, if the Dalai Lama went to San Diego to give a talk, he'd go to San Diego to give a talk. He'd follow at that time, the Dalai Lama was wearing these glasses that had like dark plastic on top and silver below, so the dark plastic was very visible. And my friend began to wear glasses like the Dalai Lama, you know. It's so human, right? You know, we imitate the people we admire, but of course, you know, watch out, right? Because Buddhism is not about being like the Dalai Lama. Buddhism is about being empty and having no expectations for or against anything. And the Buddhist view is that when we live our lives like that, we're actually more creative, more awake, more helpful, more compassionate than when we're struggling. There's something so desperate in trying to be a self. There's something, as soon as you find yourself you're feeling desperate, like, I'm not able to be a self. I'm not achieving my goal of being a self, right? You know you're in a bad place. You know, that's the thing with Lopu. He's trying to be a person. You know, he's trying to be a monk. He's trying to be a great monk, a great man of Zen. And that's toxic. That's poison. You know, the people like Lin Ji, Wu Mong, and so on and so on, these are all people who have given up on that fantasy. They know we're here for just a moment. You know, we're here for just a moment. Right? Everything blows away like the wind. Everything blows away, impermanence, right? Buddha's first teaching was everything, you know, someday people are going to go, Shakespeare? Who the hell was Shakespeare? Right? It's going to happen. I swear it's going to happen. Everything will go away. All we really have is this moment. And if we're fully present with this moment, you know, that's so wonderful, so liberating, and so beautiful. How do we do that? You know, you go into emptiness, you sit on the cushion in samadhi, but, you know, really, submission, right? It's like acquiescence. Whatever is happening is happening. My job is not to say yes or no to what is happening. My job is to be fully present with what is happening. Fully present with, fully awake and present with what is happening. So, you know, acquiescence is a way of life for we Buddhist people, right? Whatever happens, happens. Whatever is happening has to happen. We're present with what is happening. Christian tradition, people say, thy will be done. It's like, this is God's will. In Islam, they say, inshallah, so as Allah wants it to be, right? You know, that's really quite wise, actually, right? It's like, everything is happening exactly as it has to happen. My job is not to say yes or no. My job is to be present and be helpful, right? That's the true spirit of the Dharma. Be present and be helpful, but have no expectations for or against anything. You can't make anything happen, and you can't stop anything from happening. So your job is to be present with it as it happens, as it unfolds, and to be helpful. Introduction. Quick action and swift intellect break the onslaught of outsiders and heavenly devils. Leaving convention and transcending sect indirectly helps those of superior faculties with sharp wisdom. If you suddenly meet someone who doesn't even turn his head when struck, what then? See, in other words, look, you know, every once in a while we meet somebody who has no expectations for or against anything, who's simply present in a helpful, awakened way. That's a remarkable person. That's a person of the way. When you meet such people, we feel good in the presence of such people because their freedom makes us feel good too. When Luopu called on Jiashan, without bowing, he stood right in front of him. Jiashan said, I see a chicken roosting in a phoenix nest. They're not the same species. Go away. Luopu said, I've come far to find out your way, teacher. I beg for you to receive me. And Jashan said, there's no one to receive, you know, and there's no one to be received. Get rid of that fantasy. Jashan said, stop. Oh, then Lodhpu gives a shout, like trying to show I'm an awakened person. And Jashan says, stop, stop, don't be crude and careless. You know, how can you really be a selfish, be a selfless person, be a person without a self, be a person without a name, without a goal, without a dream, without a future? In the modern world, that just sounds terrible, but those are the freest people in the world. That's where real compassion comes from. Lopu had nothing to say. Jashan hit him. From this Lopu to this Lopu acquiesced. So he's beginning to be present in the moment without expectations. Wagging his head, shaking his tail, the red-tailed fish, independent through and through, he knows how to turn around. Even if he has the art to cut off tongues, pulling his nose around subtly conveyed the spirit. Outside the spruing of luminous jewels, wind and moon are like day. In front of the cliff of dead trees, flowers and plants, always in spring. When you give up on the self, the project of the self, the world is always spring, right? It's, everything is fresh, everything is new. Tongueless man, the true order is completely upheld in one knowing phrase. Walking alone in the kingdom, clear and comprehending, let everyone in the land be free and joyful.